This is Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's your host, Dr. Kirk Heinze.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome back to Greening of the Great Lakes, widely read and highly respected auto critic and columnist for the Detroit Free Press, Mark Phelan.
Oh, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
Well, last year about this time, we were talking about the green buzz surrounding the auto show. And here we are now, a year later. Where is that buzz this year?
It's more deeply embedded in the vehicles than ever. I mean, one of the things that I find interesting about this show is that we're seeing vehicles that in the past would not have had much of a green emphasis building it right into the basics of the vehicle. I mean, you know, high-powered sports cars are now also talking about fuel economy and what they're doing, you know, to reduce emissions. One of the most eagerly anticipated, you know, cars at the show is the new Corvette. And when Chevrolet is talking about it, they talk about better fuel economy in the past, you know, more efficient engines, lighter weight. There's also a concept of a pickup truck from Ford that shows a lot of new technologies for how to reduce, you know, fuel consumption. So now we're at the point where everybody has to think in green terms for every vehicle, even ones where speed and hauling capability were previously the only major concerns.
And I think it's important for our listeners to know, and you know better than I, but this green buzz takes a variety of forms. You just mentioned that. I mean, for example, turbochargers are back, but those turbochargers are going on smaller engines, so the fuel economy is better than maybe it was back in the 80s, but you still get the power.
Definitely. One of the most widespread trends is switching from, say, a 3.5-liter V6 engine down to a 2-liter or maybe a 1.5-liter even turbocharged 4-cylinder engine. And that means that under most conditions, you're using far less fuel than you would with the V6. But if you find yourself, you know, under conditions where you need to accelerate quickly or you just want to drive faster, you've still got the power because the turbo gives you that in reserve. Turbochargers and superchargers, which do essentially the same thing but just to achieve the goal in a slightly different way, they're going to be very common, and we're going to see them in a lot of mainstream vehicles.
Well, even in trucks, I was reading about the Ford F-150 that has now a turbocharged 6-cylinder engine, but apparently gives it the same oomph that it had when it was an 8-cylinder engine.
That was one of the big surprises last year because, you know, pickup owners tend to be very, very nuts and bolts, very practical. I mean, many of them look at the pickup as a tool they need to do their job, so they evaluate it just on the basis of the numbers, and they love V8s because V8s give them the potential to carry lots of stuff around. They're very reliable. They're an established technology. Ford comes along with a much smaller V6 engine, and they say, we can tow even more stuff with this little V6 than you can with your big V8. Most of us were pretty skeptical about whether pickup buyers would embrace that idea, but they love it. V6s ended up being more than 50% of the F-150s that Ford sold last year, which is something that I don't think any of us expected.
And that V6 with the turbocharger, just generally speaking, across models and brands, what kind of fuel savings are we talking about?
You know, the rule of thumb is generally around 20%. You can have the same amount of power with 20% less fuel consumption. It'll vary based on a lot of other things, but yeah, that's a good bogey to consider.
Let's also, another form of green technology, of course, the plug-in hybrids. In one of your recent blogs, you said, or you asked the question, is this the year the plug-in hybrids take off?
Yeah, because we've got more of them coming to market. That technology seems to have matured considerably over the last couple of years, and the early indications are that pure electric vehicles that have a battery and, you know, no gasoline engine as backup are kind of a tough sell for people because they're expensive and they've got a relatively limited cruising range. I mean, the Nissan Leaf is a perfect example. Costs around $35,000 before all of the tax credits are applied, and you can go about 78 miles on a fully charged battery. That's perfect for some people, but most of us who need to maybe be able to drive from Detroit to Lansing on the drop of a hat, that's not going to be a vehicle that works for us. Plug-in hybrids give people the opportunity to drive purely in electric mode for some distance. And, you know, how far they can do that depends on how big the batteries are, how expensive the vehicle is. But you've got, you know, 10, 15, 20, in the case of the Chevy Volt, almost 40 miles of pure plug-in range. And then if you do want to go farther, there's also a gasoline engine available so that you're not going to be stranded. That seems to be the technology that people like, the flexibility that that gives them. And there are a lot of new ones going on the market this year, including a version of the Ford Fusion. The Toyota Prius has got one they just introduced. And there's a new Cadillac coming that uses almost the exact same drivetrain as the Chevy Volt. And it's absolutely gorgeous.
As you know, I drive an electric vehicle, and I love it. But your point was that people who are a little nervous about range may prefer these hybrids to electric vehicles.
And particularly the plug-in hybrid, where you've got a big enough battery that you can go for a few miles purely on electricity that you got while you were plugged in before you started driving. But then if you want to go farther, there's also an engine that can either serve as a generator to make more electricity in the case of the Chevy Volt, or it just takes over and the car runs like a conventional hybrid for some other models.
And it's amazing, Mark, and you probably find this as well, the people who still don't know the difference between a pure electric and a hybrid. And it has to do with that internal combustion engine. Maybe a quick explanation of the difference, very succinctly, between the hybrid and the pure electric.
Sure. Well, and in some sense, it comes down to the way the auto companies themselves talk about them. They talk about battery electric vehicles, or BEVs, and that's one where the only power source you've got in the vehicle is a battery, and you plug it into the wall, you know, before you start driving, and you can drive until it is drained, and then you're stuck. The Nissan Leaf is an example of that. Hybrids and plug-in hybrids allow you to also have a gasoline engine. So they've got a smaller battery that provides power to move the vehicle for some distance that will vary depending on the kind of a car. But then beyond that distance, they've also got the gasoline engine. They reduce fuel consumption very, very significantly depending on the individual model. But they also let you go farther, and that's the capability that seems to be appealing to a lot of people.
And in the case of the Volt, for example, which I own, when the battery is drained, then an electric generator essentially kicks on. It is not an internal combustion engine, but it does operate on gas, and frankly, it gives me about 38, 39 miles to the gallon.
Exactly. And the distinction between some plug-in hybrids and extended-range electric vehicles like the Volt gets so technical that I'm at the point now where I kind of lump them all into one thing, because they let you go purely with electricity for most of your driving, and then when you need it, they've got, you know, a backup system.
Let's go with an old faithful here for a moment, lest we forget, but there are some new developments on the diesel front as well.
Absolutely, and one of the things that a lot of people aren't aware of is that diesel can cut your fuel consumption 25% to 30% as soon as you put a diesel into a vehicle. And they're tremendously popular in Europe, much more popular than hybrids or electric cars. But diesels have not really become mainstream here. This year, we're going to see more automakers applying them. At the auto show, there's a new Jeep Grand Cherokee that's got a diesel engine. This is one of the fruits of Jeep's, of Chrysler's alliance with Fiat, because Fiat's one of the world leaders in diesel technology. Jeep owners have been asking for a diesel for years because it's more fuel efficient and it produces more power than a similar sized gasoline engine. So, and we're going to see, I expect that we're going to see them lined up by the diesel Jeep Grand Cherokee. Later on this year, we'll have a diesel Chevy Cruze that could get as much as 50 miles a gallon on the highway, and other diesels are going to be working their way in. So diesel is a significant contributor to reducing fuel consumption and emissions.
You know, Mark, you made this point last year, and you make it frequently in your columns and on your blog, but this business with the diesel and the new technology and the fuel savings, it just underscores the point that you so often make about the portfolio of products that are available to consumers these days. The auto companies really trying to produce a plethora of products that appeal to a wide range of interests, demographics, and psychographics.
Very much. There's no one solution that's going to work for everybody, but they're developing such a menu of solutions that just about anybody has got some option available to them that will use a lot less fuel, create a lot fewer emissions than a similar vehicle would have, you know, 5-6 years ago.
I'm talking to Detroit Free Press auto columnist Mark Phelan. Mark, here's a chance to, every year you select the Free Press Car and Truck of the Year. This year your Car of the Year was Cadillac ATS. The truck was the Ram 1500. Why do you like those so much?
Well, the Ram was very interesting because it was one of the first vehicles that embodied the trend I was talking about of high-performance vehicles, vehicles with a lot of capability, also really emphasizing fuel economy. It's a big pickup truck, but it uses an 8-speed automatic transmission and an automatic stop-and-start system, which is similar to what's in a lot of hybrids, to reduce fuel consumption quite a bit. The ATS is just a perfect example of one of the classic types of car, the small sport sedan. It's the best-selling type of luxury car all around the world. It was something that Cadillac had not tried to produce yet. The CTS is a terrific car, but it's bigger than, say, a BMW 3 Series or now the Cadillac ATS. With the ATS, Cadillac said, we're confident that we can do something that's the same size and just as good as a BMW 3 Series, and I think they succeeded. It's a terrific car.
You know, Mark, I know you like to talk about the cars and the technology. I mean, you've had a long-time love affair with the automobile industry and probably typically tend to stay away from some of the political stuff. But there's a question I do have to ask you this year. The buzz the last couple of years around the auto show has been so great. The auto industry seems to be back and getting stronger. A lot of good news. The whole business of the government stepping in and helping General Motors and Chrysler in retrospect. I mean, some people still criticize that decision. Most people I talk to think that it was something good that the government did. Your take on all of that?
I'm on the side that says that it was the right thing to do. I think that the whole country's economy was teetering on the brink in 2008 and 2009. And if a huge manufacturing company, a huge employer, something that, you know, influences every corner of the economy, like General Motors, if that company had been allowed to go out of business, I have a really hard time believing that it wouldn't have, you know, pushed the whole economy over the brink. And if you look at it now, they're making money, they're adding workers, they're contributing in just about every way you would want to the national economy. And pretty much the same goes for Chrysler just on a smaller scale because they are a somewhat smaller company. But I think it was the right thing to do. I think that it was absolutely necessary.
Well, Mark, we've got about a minute left here. And other things that visitors to the auto show should be looking for that perhaps we haven't mentioned?
Well, real quickly, Cobo Center at Detroit is getting an almost complete makeover, and a lot of that will be visible this year, including a beautiful new atrium that looks out over the river and takes advantage of the physical location. And watch out for small crossover vehicles, compact and subcompact crossover vehicles that look like SUVs but much smaller, get very good fuel economy. That's one of the next growth segments, and we will see a few of those on the show floor this year.
I imagine some of the bells and whistles inside, some of the electronic gadgetry and the communications technology is just going to be mind-boggling as usual.
Oh, absolutely. There's no stopping there. Full speed ahead on all fronts.
Well, I've been talking with Mark Phelan, who's auto columnist and critic for the Detroit Free Press. We have this chat every year during the auto show. Mark, thanks so much again for being a guest on Greening of the Great Lakes.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Greening of the Great Lakes with Dr. Kirk Heinze on MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Find more online at greeningofthegreatlakes.com.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. We've all heard the expression, it's all about who you know. And wherever you are on your career ladder, having a friend on the inside can make all the difference. When you join the MSU Alumni Association family, you're instantly connected to 500,000 Spartans around the world, many of whom are key decision makers in just about every major enterprise. Whether you're looking for a way in or a way up, your MSU Alumni Association affiliation can help you link up with that MSU alum who'll always take your call just because you're a Spartan. Building your network right now before you need it is the best possible career insurance, and joining the MSU Alumni Association is the best possible way to get the most out of your Spartan life. Learn more online at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Satish Udpa is the Dean of the College of Engineering at Michigan State University. And Dean Udpa, it's great to have you on the show.
My pleasure. My pleasure to be able to chat with you today.
Can we start by talking in general about the field of engineering? It's so big, it's so pervasive. A lot of people think only of the automotive industry when they think of engineering. But talk about where engineering is in 2008 and then how this college fits into that.
That's unfortunate, the perception that we are involved only in the automotive world and have little to do with the rest of the world is unfortunate. Look around you. Everything that is around you has practically been put together by an engineer, whether it's the automobile that you came in to work today, the lights that you see here today, the television monitor that television that you watched this morning, the microwave that you turned on this morning to have your cup of coffee, the furniture that you are sitting in, the building that you are in, just about everything that is around you has been put together by engineers. Engineers have practically put together this man-made world.
And how does MSU's College of Engineering fit in the modern world of engineering?
Engineering is an evolving profession. The kinds of challenges that we address today were not the challenges that we addressed yesterday. So every now and then, the College of Engineering picks up some priorities. And right now, the priorities that we have embraced are the fields of energy, health, materials, sustainability, and security. Those are priorities for us. That does not mean that we don't want to work in other areas. But if we had resources, these are areas that we would plow those resources in.
And expand on that, what the strengths of this college are and what sets this college apart from some others.
The college is on a growth path. We have made significant investments in the last 5 to 10 years in some specific selected areas, and all of that investment is beginning to pay off. For example, let's take the case of energy. We have embraced this concept that the whole campus seems to have embraced, and that is to work on this idea of working all the way from crops to wheels. Some campuses, for example, look at the transportation and, you know, how can we design better engines and so forth. We go all the way back to where it should start. For example, we think that the days of $20 hydrocarbons are over, $20 a barrel hydrocarbons are over. The world has changed significantly in the last few years, and the cost of energy is going to go up unless we take some active, proactive steps. One source of energy that we think is very viable is biofuels. This is, you know, energy that we can take off of or obtain from biological sources. Again, there's been a lot of hullabaloo. There's been a lot of excitement about producing fuel from corn. We think that this is not the right strategy. Whenever you take foodstuffs and use that to convert that into fuel, you are asking for a set of problems that you are somewhat difficult to address. Every time you go to the grocery store, you see an increase in prices that can be attributed in some way or the other to the rise in the cost of corn. We have also seen a number of riots in the third world in the past few months, and this can be attributed to the fact that the cost of food has gone up. We, as a rich, advanced nation, might be able to absorb some of the cost, but third world countries have a very, very difficult time adjusting to this new scenario. What has engineering done? Well, we're looking at crops that can be grown without affecting the food chain, for example. We are looking at grasses that can be grown sustainably and derive ethanol from cellulosic materials. We are looking at special types of oil seeds, for example, that can be grown, and we can get biodiesel from them. We want to make sure that whatever we focus on ultimately results in a sustainable source of energy. The other thing that we are also working on, we are also looking at clever ways in which we can extract fuel from these. So our chemical engineers are heavily engaged in that process. We also have on the other end mechanical engineers working on new paradigms for building automobiles tomorrow, engines that can take advantage of these new fuels, automobile designs that can take advantage of these new engines. You know, it's an exciting world from an engineering perspective, because we are looking at a number of issues that I think are going to fundamentally affect the way we live in the next 100 years.
And what are some of your immediate and long-term goals here in the College of Engineering?
Our goal is to be a leader in whatever we are engaged in. You know, one of the ways to sort of benchmark oneself is to look at other institutions. And I'd like to be able to say that we are in the top quartile of the NRC, National Research Council ranked institutions. What does this do to us? Well, it allows us to attract the best faculty. It allows us to attract the best students. And so that's a metric that we might be able to embrace and do very well in the next few years. We're getting there. And that's one of the more interesting things that are happening.
Satish Udpa is the Dean of the College of Engineering at Michigan State University. And, sir, the college has seen a 40% increase in research dollars over the last 5 years. What kind of research will this allow the college to conduct? And talk a little bit more about some of the major accomplishments or current areas of research in the college that's funded by these dollars.
Our goal is to continue on this path. Our goal is to make sure that in the next 5 years or so, our research expenditures increase to $60 million or so, which is roughly about 80% more than what it is right now. That will allow us to do a lot of things. We can then begin to see an impact on these five areas that I talked about, whether it's energy or health. In health, for example, we are in the process of establishing an Institute of Engineering and Health. This will allow us to translate technologies that are currently developed in the laboratories here in this building to clinical settings. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the goal of every engineer is to make sure that the kinds of things that we work on eventually helps mankind. And this is a great way of influencing the way we do our work.
What role does the College of Engineering play in major university initiatives like the bioeconomy? You've been talking about that, but you reach across campus to work with a lot of different units, don't you?
A good portion of my day gets spent in talking to other deans in the university. This is it's a great place to do research. I have a bunch of colleagues who are extremely collegial, who are extremely committed to the cause of doing interdisciplinary research. And that's wonderful. I get up in the morning and feel excited about the day that's ahead of me, because I can talk to the other deans, the other administrators here in the university, and work with them. For example, we have seen more plant scientists in this college in the last few months than at any other time in our lives. This is exciting. Whenever you have a plant scientist talking to a chemical engineering professor and finding out, you know, what is it, what kinds of things do we need to have in crops that are eventually going to produce fuels? What kinds of enzymes are required in order to be able to process these crops? Those are exciting conversations that, you know, should have taken place long ago, but you're beginning to have that, and that's wonderful. And it can take place in an institution as large as Michigan State University.
And how is the college impacting the undergraduate education and Are the engineering students of today any different than they were 15, 20, 30 years ago? And how are you attracting people and sharing your passion for engineering with students seeking, you know, a desire of trying to figure out what they want to go into?
This is, again, an exciting time. Times are changing, and these present exciting opportunities for engineering programs. Today, the biggest sources of technical manpower and the biggest markets are on the other side of the globe. What that means is that routine engineering jobs are going to be done elsewhere because they can be done much more cheaply. What does that do for us? It means that our engineers have to be trained to be able to get into the next tier of jobs. They ought to be able to integrate things. They ought to be able to take things that are done by engineers elsewhere and put them together. So you might have an automobile component today manufactured in China, but the basic structure of an automobile, the basic design of an automobile, that has to be done here in the United States. And we need to train our students to be able to do that. What does that entail from a curricular point of view? Well, our students not only have to be great engineers, but they also have to be able to communicate with people in other disciplines. They ought to be able to talk to people in management. They ought to be able to talk to people in law. They ought to be able to talk to people in social sciences, for example. And the ability to communicate with people in other disciplines is increasingly becoming very, very important. So we're looking for students with T personalities, where the vertical member represents depth in their respective engineering field, and the horizontal member then represents the broad ability to communicate with people in other disciplines. So that's what we're trying to do. Now, the next question is, how are we going to accomplish that? One of the things that we are working on right now is a residential program in the College of Engineering. This will allow our students to have design labs, for example, in the same place where they live. They'll be able to have computer labs where they will be able to, in the same residential hall. Not only that, we are hoping to embed students from entrepreneurship program, for example, in the business college. We are hoping to embed people from social sciences or pre-law students all in the residence program so that our students pick up skills through the process of osmosis as opposed to classroom education. And we think that's the best way of absorbing skills.
You've started to talk about this, sir, but tell me a little bit more about the skills the employers now are looking for when they come to hire your graduates, and have they changed?
Yes, that has changed significantly. 15 or 20 years ago, companies would come to us and say, give us 15 engineers or 20 engineers, and they'd be satisfied with the kinds of people that we send. Today, they are looking for people with specific types of skills, and that's where I think graduates from Michigan State University would have a great advantage, because we are training them to have these skills, the ability, again, I'm repeating myself here, the ability to communicate with people in other disciplines and depth in a particular discipline. They're also looking for people with some experience in their toolkit. So we are emphasizing internships and co-ops. We are also exposing our students to undergraduate research opportunities. So we see our undergraduate students working side by side with graduate students and faculty on some exciting problems, on cutting-edge problems. And this will prepare our students to undertake things that they would not normally have done 10 or 15 years ago. Again, I emphasize, these are exciting times. My only regret is that I was born 50 years too late.
How do you see not only the college, but the field of engineering evolving as we move forward now?
Again, if you look at the kinds of things that came out in the last 5 or 10 years, take the case of entertainment, for example, the high-definition television, Blu-ray, this DVD drives, look at the laptops that are coming out, look at the iPods, the iPhones. All of these things are happening in just one small area of engineering. I think our entertainment needs are going to grow. We are going to be a part of the solution there. Take the case of transportation. I think if you had been to the Detroit Auto Show, you would have seen a number of exciting new designs coming out, vehicles that can probably in 5 to 10 years travel 1,000 miles between recharges or refills, offer at least 250 miles to a gallon. fuel efficiency. These are the kinds of things that engineers are going to be working on in the next few years, whether it's entertainment, whether it's transportation, whether it's in construction. If you look at some of the exciting architectures that are coming out, all of these things require new materials, new design paradigms. And again, engineers are at the forefront in many of these exciting areas.
And what about particularly for this college moving forward?
We are concerned about a number of things here. One of the things that we are particularly concerned about is a lack of or perceived lack of interest among the young in science and technology. And this is particularly true of women. If you look at the demographics of the student population here in the College of Engineering, roughly 20% of our students are women. Now, the last time I looked outside, 50% of our population happened to be women. And it's a crying shame that we don't see more women in the College of Engineering. So we have got programs here in place now. We have a women in engineering program that is being spearheaded by Judy Fortes, who is actively going out and communicating with women in schools and in elementary schools and middle schools and high schools. And we're communicating the joy of leading a life in science and engineering. That's an exciting area for us. We've also been at the forefront in organizing a number of competitions for students in the middle schools and the high schools. We have some of the largest robotics programs that attracts close to 1,100 or 1,200 kids in a year to the campus. Again, with the avowed purpose of getting them educated or getting them interested in science and technology. We also have some exciting things going on for attracting students from underrepresented communities to the college. We are actively working with the DAPSA program that works in the Detroit public schools. We also have other programs that brings a sizable number of students from the underrepresented communities to the College of Engineering. We think that given the number of engineers that are needed out there and given the exciting challenges that lie ahead, we need as many engineers as we can. And that means that we've got to draw talent from communities that have hitherto been neglected. And so I'd like to see more women as engineers. I'd like to see more students from underrepresented communities as engineers. And we will do everything in our power to get them excited about this field.
Dean Udpai, as we close, what would you like people joining in on our conversation to know or remember about MSU's College of Engineering?
I'd like people to realize this is a place that is committed to being at the forefront in science and engineering. We are taking on problems that truly matter. These are problems that are going to affect our lives for the next 50 years, 100 years. And we've got to be coming up with the most creative of solutions. The faculty in the College of Engineering, the students in the College of Engineering are engaged in that activity. And the impact that our graduates will have, I think I'm truly, truly excited about that.
Sir, thanks for sharing your time and insights with us today.
Thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to talk with you.
Satish Udpai is the Dean of the College of Engineering at Michigan State University, and there's much more on the web about everything we've talked about at egr.msu.edu.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. The Michigan State University Department of Radiology is a leader in MRI, imaging research, and patient care. From world-class research to state-of-the-art patient care, we're providing outstanding diagnostic imaging technology. We're also a leader in sports medicine, delivering quality care to athletes and sports participants of all ages. Visit us online at rad.msu.edu and see how we are boldly designing the future.
MSU Today is online at spartanpodcast.com. Here's Russ White.
Dan Gould is the director of the Institute for the Study of Youth Sports at Michigan State University. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me, what is the Institute for the Study of Youth Sports at MSU? What's your mission? What do you do there?
Well, the Institute's about 30 years old, and we were started by the state legislature and for the purpose of studying the beneficial and detrimental effects of sport for children and youth, and then to do things that maximize the beneficial effects and minimize the detrimental.
That makes sense. And tell me a little bit about your background and why you became interested in this area.
I became interested in it as I played high school youth sports, high school sports, college sports. Went to school to be a physical educator, coach, and ended up a sports scientist. But always felt youth sports were, from Little League baseball to high school wrestling to college wrestling, was a great experience for me. I learned a lot, but I also saw some horror stories, and I go, wow, you can study these things and maybe help people have sport do what it did for me, for a lot of other people. So that's how I got interested. This is my first job after my PhD, so I came here when the Institute started in the late 70s, then left, and I came back 3 years ago to sort of take over the Institute. So it's coming full circle, and I love Michigan. And if you move from North Carolina to come to Michigan, you know you love the state.
True. And well, what are the main issues that you deal with and research in the Institute?
A number of different issues. Some of the things we're interested now in is how do we train coaches, train parents, train leaders to do a better job in children's sports to maximize the benefits. When we think of sports for kids, we don't think of it as automatically good nor automatically bad. It's a neat environment that has the potential to do a lot of good things, but if done poorly, has the potential to have negative effects. So a lot of what we do are, what are the biggest issues? We're trying to identify those, study some of those issues, bring to bear the power of the university in terms of assimilating knowledge, generating it, then packaging it in a way, in the tradition of the land grant, that real people can understand it, not all the academic jargon, to programs and policies to help make sports better for kids.
I would assume some of the issues then are like coaches coaching the right way to not destroy self-esteem and not to overemphasize winning, I'm just guessing here. And maybe the parents keeping the proper perspective and not being overbearing.
Yeah, we do a lot of work now. We do a lot of work with the Michigan High School Association on remembering that kids' sport and high school sport is educational athletics. How do we not only teach kids how to compete, nothing wrong with that, but that gets blown out of proportion, to become a better person through sports participation, learn how to deal with victory and defeat, to develop physical benefits, help combat the obesity crisis by falling in love with physical activity. Increasing issues today with parents getting over-involved in sport. We're doing a lot of research right now on life skills. What can kids learn through sport and extracurricular activities like initiative, teamwork? And then how can they transfer that beyond sport? And what role does a coach play in that?
Dan, one interesting thing that caught my eye on your website, which is youthsports.msu.edu, one of your goals, you say, is to eliminate some of the myths that are out there related to youth sports and enhance the positive health behaviors at the same time. What are some of the myths and then the realities in your area?
Yeah, I think there's a number of things. I think maybe putting it into a larger context, we live in an amazing information age.
Yep.
And on one hand, we have all this great information on the internet, but on the other hand, you drown in it. And you don't know what's good and not good. So parents hear things and they get ideas. Like, we've met parents, well-meaning, love their kids, but they're giving their son or daughter Red Bull before a game to give them an emotional kick. Or they hear about good nutrition, but they hear about these magic supplements, mm-hmm. and all sorts of supplements. Or the more the better. So they're having their kids specialize at very young ages and train year-round, and that could lead to injuries. So a lot of times parents don't get the best information, and then they implement things that unknowingly could have detrimental effects. So we're trying to show what's effective, what's ineffective, then get the right information out to parents so they can achieve their goal of producing a better kid that enjoys sport and falls in love with physical activity.
And obviously, I'm sure the website is one, but what are some of the ways you get your research and information out to the people who need it?
A number of ways. One is we do different programs. Like, we work a lot with the Michigan High School Athletic Association. We've helped develop their coaches education program, the modules that they use to train many of Michigan's high school coaches. We work with a group down in Detroit, Think Detroit, the Police Athletic League, that has programs for 13,000 kids in Detroit. We help develop their coaching education program. We're doing another project with the Michigan High School Association, a captain's leadership training. where we work with the MHSA to have conferences where 100 team captains will come in, or potential captains, and we spend a day teaching kids how to lead so they can maybe learn some skills, as opposed to, I'm the captain, so now what do I do? I'm the captain, here are some roles. And where that's important, hopefully it will help all the kids have a better sport experience. What excites me is maybe some of those kids will learn skills about leadership that could help them when they enter business or school or become a teacher or firefighter, so transfer beyond the sport venue.
Dan Gould is with us on MSU Today, director of the Institute for the Study of Youth Sports at Michigan State University. And Dan, is it just me in kind of a squeaky wheel gets the grease type of image, or does it seem like so many parents are out of whack with their as far as their kids' sports lives go? When you're at a soccer game or a basketball game, there always seem to be a couple that are just out of control. Is that the minority, and how do you deal with that phenomenon?
Yeah, we've done some studies in different sports. We did a project for U.S. Tennis, and we interviewed coaches around the country and surveyed, and they reported about 7 of 10 parents are just fine. And this is pretty consistent with our experience. The majority of parents are trying to do a good job. All of us make a mistake once in a while, sure, but good intentions. 30% or 3 of 10 parents might do some things that often unknowingly negatively affect their child or the program. So it's sort of the minority of parents. But one thing that concerns us, it seems to be growing. Mm. And the other thing is some of the bad parent behavior, lack of a better word, seems to get so much attention that some coaches don't want to coach anymore. Officials don't want to get involved because of parents on them. And it has the potential to really make youth sport a bad thing for if we don't solve it. So there's a lot of focus now on how to help parents first, what people often forget, help the good parents to keep doing the good things, catch them doing things right, better inform them, and also to develop programs to deal with a squeaky wheel, help it be quieter, help the parent get back on track, or if they're way out of whack and they don't want to get on track, maybe help them get out of that program.
Well, Dan, let's do some of the tips then. What tips do you have? Maybe they're the same, but maybe not. For those 7 in 10 that are fine, what are some things to keep in mind to remain a good sports parent? And what about for those 3 in 10 or whatever it is, the parents that need to calm down a bit and get this into perspective?
You hit it with your last statement, perspective. Youth sports has a lot of objectives. Having the child become physically fit, fall in love with physical activity, teach skills or learn skills to be taught skills, some what we call life skills, learn things like teamwork. So there's a number of objectives. In school, we find kids who are in extracurricular activities like sport stay more connected to school, actually do a little better. So there's all these objectives. Competition is a worthy objective and is part of the equation. But I probably listed 5 objectives in total, and competition is one. But because of the emphasis in our culture, that one gets so big sometimes it supersedes all the rest. And it's easy for a parent to get caught up in that. Your child wins, you feel pretty good. A lot of times your child does well, all the other parents treat you differently, and your worth as a parent sort of gets judged by your child's achievements. And before you know it, you're forgetting about the other objectives. So we really try to do things to help parents keep aware of all these different objectives and recognizing competition is part of the equation, but it's like 1/5 or whatever objectives we have, and you got to keep it in perspective.
Do coaches then have similar things to keep in mind, Dan? There are some different ones too. What about the coaches?
Well, I think coaches, the same thing, perspective. In our work with the Michigan High School group, we talk about how do we keep educational athletics educational and not forget that it's not just winning, it's other things. The 95% of the kids in Michigan high school sport are never going to see a college stadium.
Yeah.
And how do we make sure it's an experience in their life that helps them throughout their life?
And the children, I mean, the kids playing, maybe it seems odd to ask them to keep things in mind, but what advice do you have for kids to have the best youth sports experience they can have?
That's a tough one. I mean, I think some of it for the kids is for us as adult leaders, parents, is to listen to the kids.
Yeah.
But also for kids to realize part of sport today is learning some tough lessons. It's not always going to be rosy, and you may, you know, lose a sectional game or have a defeat, and learning to overcome that. I think sometimes our society emphasizes the individual so much and individual attention that some kids really need those teamwork lessons and need to learn how to fail. And I mean, obviously we focus on making every kid a winner if we can by judging individual success. But some of the lessons in life are tough, and helping kids learn to deal with those challenges, sport can be a good vehicle for that if done the right way.
Because is there, it was a joke in Meet the Parents or Meet the Fackers or whatever, but the Ben Stiller character, there were some jokes about a ninth place ribbon in swimming. And is there a little bit too much worrying about the self-esteem and everybody needs a fifth place ribbon for everything? Shouldn't you learn at the same time it's 1, 2, 3 or try harder?
Yeah, it's an interesting point you make about sort of the dosage of positive versus real world. And as a child gets older, we're trying to kind of give them some of both. I mean, you don't want failure.
No.
But it comes with a territory. And I think sometimes we know self-esteem's critical. But in the past, it's been a very simplistic notion that you just run around and tell kids they're positive. And almost all the research that's been done at coaching and parents, yeah, kids need positive reinforcement, but it's got to be earned and it's got to be realistic, or they develop a false sense of themselves. So it's sort of like it's got to be real, and you're looking, catch them doing things right. And sometimes you have to give them feedback they may not want to hear, and that's part of the process. Now, it doesn't need to be done in a derogatory way or yelling at Bobby Knight or, you know, like some of these images. But you have to be real with kids, especially as they get older. Yeah, you didn't do very well, but, you know, last week you didn't practice very hard. So, you know, I don't yell at the kid, but I tell that child that that's part of the process. And if you put money in the bank, you can take it out. If you don't put money in the bank, you may want to win, but you may not because you didn't have anything to make a withdrawal with.
What about as we move forward in the weeks and months and years ahead, Dan, what are some of the issues you see arising? Are they the current ones evolving, or are there some new things you're seeing on the horizon that you're going to be researching?
Probably the single biggest issues that concerns us at the Institute is what I've sort of labeled the professionalization of youth sports. Youth sports is not professional entertainment sport. It's not MSU basketball, football. Its purpose is personal development, fitness, of these multitude of objectives to make a better kid, to get the kid more physically active. And what happens in our sort of media-driven culture, the Super Bowl was recently on, and so much emphasis gets placed on the winning and the outcome. And people see, I mean, they put on a great show, it's fun to watch, etc. But all of a sudden, that drifts down to the colleges, and then it drifts down to the high school, and it drifts down to the youth sports. And in fact, I talked to somebody today, a really good person, but they were talking about their son's 5-year-old soccer game, and he knew the league record, and he knew how many goals, and the other kids were getting better. And before we know it, that developmental sport experience has become sort of an elite sport experience. So how do we kind of keep sports in a developmental progression? Like we often talk about, the best way to build an Olympic champion or a MSU men or women basketball player or football athlete is you start out with fun and fundamentals. They need to play a lot of sports, fall in love with the game, enjoy it, get hooked on it. Then they move into maybe the high school level. They learn how to train. They hit some bumps in the road. I mean, reality and like anything other endeavor,
right.
It's not always easy. And then if they're talented enough and lucky enough, they can move to the next level where it gets more serious. But even there, winning with integrity. So you don't take steroids. Sure, they could help you, but it's not right. You don't cheat. So how do we kind of create a system that allows talented kids to move from the cradle to the podium and at the same time doesn't penalize kids who are not lucky enough to be gifted but may get to the high school level, have a great experience that they remember for their life, learn some important lessons, fall in love with physical activity? Our biggest concern is this professionalized approach is drifting down and getting in the way of these other objectives.
Hmm. And how do you see then MSU's Institute for the Study of Youth Sports that you lead, how does your mission evolve over the years to meet these challenges?
Yeah, I think one of the big ones for us today is we're the only institute of our type in the United States, and I know of one other one in the world. Somebody who's out there kind of assessing what's going on in youth sport from an objective manner, and then maybe collecting data, doing research, collecting information to get out to the community so we can make more informed judgments. So that's one of our roles, sort of this unbiased provider of information about what's happening on the ground. Or we identify problems and then we bring to bear all the wonderful university resources to answer a question. And I think what makes us really unique, but it fits perfectly with the first land-grant university in the United States and the world, is then our role is to take that information and package it, train leaders, provide information for parents that can help them help their kids have a wonderful experience and get some nice benefits from it.
As we close then, Dan, what would you like people to remember or know about your Institute for the Study of Youth Sports?
Our job is to monitor what's going on in youth sport, identify benefits and detriments, and work to try to maximize the benefits, minimize the detriments. Again, we're not like most things in the university today. We used to be state-funded, and now we have to write grants and trying to get money to study some of these issues. But we're here as a resource within those constraints. Like our website, we don't sell anything. It's there for information for the public.
Dan, thanks so much for joining us on MSU Today.
Thank you.
Dan Gould is the director of the Institute for the Study of Youth Sports at Michigan State University, and the website for a lot more information is simply Youth Sports, all one word, youthsports.msu.edu.
You're listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. Join the MSUAA family, and you're instantly connected to our network of over 500,000 Spartans in every corner of the world. Whether it's community, connections, career growth, or class, that's what the MSU Alumni Association is all about. Join the world's largest Spartan Nation community at alumni.msu.edu. That's alumni.msu.edu. The MSU Alumni Association, your personal network for life.
You're tuned to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Please visit us online at SpartanPodcast.com and join us every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock for MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.